You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 4th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Max Chafkin, features editor and writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel, and Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. And then, double shot today, ladies and gentlemen, executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan, on, wait for it, postal banking. Chuck Schumer sets an August 31st deadline for both infrastructure bills to get a vote as progressives hold the line and make it two track. However, did I say August? October 31st.
Oh.
Meanwhile, however, Biden pulls back on the top line to approximately $2 trillion. And meanwhile, the debt ceiling may or may not get a separate reconciliation vote. Depends on who you talk to. The Pandora, or so-called Pandora Papers, have leaked. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists released a report revealing international wealthy, elite, and corrupt leaders and their secret money holdings.
Sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm. Facebook whistleblower says that the social media behemoth will fuel any lies for its own growth. Also, sun rises in the east. Meanwhile, Amplify Energy, responsible for a major oil spill of at least 126,000 gallons washing up on the shores of Orange County, California. New York City schools' vaccine mandate in effect as of today for teachers and staff. As the Washington Post reveals that the Koch network is funding the anti-mask protests.
What?
New email dump also shows that Betsy DeVos and the Department of Education under Donald Trump collaborated with men's rights activists to rewrite campus rape guidelines.
Mm.
All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is the beginning of a new week. Hope you're feeling refreshed from the weekend. There is a buoyancy in this office that has not been here really since the beginning of, I believe,
the NFL season. On Mondays.
Yeah, on Mondays.
I recover most weeks. Last week, I don't think I recovered the whole week.
It took to closer like Thursday.
Good, thank you.
But the Giants won, so Emma Vigeland is here with a massive smile on her face.
Yes, even though I did break my phone yesterday, that's not enough to keep me down.
Well, you should be more specific. You broke your phone during the game because you threw it because you were mad at the Giants.
Nope, that didn't happen.
All right.
I thought was a personal conversation, but
well, you brought up the phone breaking, and I wanted to make it clear that you weren't just sort of picking out a random thing that it was directly related to what happened with the Giants.
Yeah, I guess I was like trying to walk a fine line here, but like honestly, again, this is what I'm saying. This will a new Apple product will have to be sacrificed as tribute.
That's the amazing thing.
Every yes. weekend. So if you miss like a few old computers over the weekend in the office, like don't worry about it.
Right.
We do have a whole bunch of like old Mac Minis.
Yeah, we do. Actually. I mean, they're literally like 12 years old.
I
think they were 12 years old when I got them.
I want to smash it like an Office Space while I'm wearing like a Odell Beckham Jr. jersey or something. Still my guy.
Whatever works, I guess. I was just lamenting that I was up until almost midnight watching a field goal bounce off one of the field goal posts, but I did have a good day with the Red Sox, so we can move forward.
And I just want to clarify, I'm so sorry. It was it really wasn't that hard. I pushed it against the couch, and it hit a buckle on my purse. So, like, it wasn't... I don't have anger mm-hmm. issues. Anyway.
Tell it to the judge.
And the Jets won.
No, congrats.
Yeah, whatever. Who cares about the Jets? All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's get right into it. If you recall, at the end of a day on Friday, what had happened was that the Progressive Caucus had done something that they had never done before, which was basically shatter the plans of the Democratic leadership to essentially kowtow to 9 members or 10 members of a corporatist caucus led by Josh Gottheimer, the Progressive Caucus representing, well, and we don't know if the numbers were 50 or 80 or 100 who were willing to not vote for the bipartisan infrastructure bill without the reconciliation bill, essentially doing the heavy lifting on behalf of the Biden administration. And then all of a sudden, guess what? The sky did not fall. They have now punted it to at least must be done by August 31st. I think 31st is a October. Saturday. October 31st. I think it is a Saturday. If I remember correctly, October 31st this year is a Sunday, actually, because that is Halloween, mm-hmm. and I've already made plans, and there's a lot of like negotiations that go on around that with my kids in Halloween. For divorced families, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how I know that. So it's really on that Friday they need to get it done, I believe, although they could theoretically do the session on Saturday and Sunday. But the bottom line is progressives held the line. Biden right now is trying to figure out how to get down to a top line number that is closer to $2 trillion. There is a myriad of ways that can happen. We've talked about that. You can means test programs, you can front load programs, you can shorten the duration of these programs and leave it up to future. We'll talk more about that in the coming days. But one of the highlights of Friday was also that one of the two major reasons, if not the biggest reason, why the Democratic agenda is being thwarted, she decided to leave Washington, D.C., because she had to do some donor meetings, and apparently over the weekend she had to teach.
And she had a doctor's appointment, right, for her foot.
And a foot doctor's appointment.
And then also went on a donor retreat that included a hike.
Oh, that's, I mean, it's nice. Get out in the air.
I hope that doctor's appointment must have really fixed your foot. I want to know if she was a part of that donor hike. Somebody find out for me.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, maybe, and nevertheless, Kristen Sinema was at Arizona State University, and she apparently teaches a class. I'm not sure what the class is about, but there were organizers from Lucha, which is a organization that defends immigrants.
Living United for Change in Arizona, and it's also Spanish for struggle.
And they confronted Kyrsten Sinema outside a classroom where she's teaching. She would not engage with them, and some of them, I think, actually followed her into the restroom. Let's watch this.
Okay, I'll be back.
Sit down, we want to talk to you real quick. Can we talk to you real quick?
Hi, actually, I am heading out.
But right now is a real moment that our people need in order for us to be able to talk about what's really happening. We need a Build Back Better plan right now.
We knocked on doors.
We need solutions. The Build Back Better plan has the solutions that we need.
We knocked on doors for you to get you elected, and just how we got you elected, we can get you out of office if you don't support what you promised us.
We need 7 million citizenship for 7 million. We need the Build Back Better plan right now.
My name is Blanca. I was brought here to the United States when I was 3 years old. And in 2010, my grandparents both got deported because of SB 1070. And I'm here because I definitely believe that we need this pathway to citizenship. My grandfather passed away 2 weeks ago, and I was not able to go to Mexico and visit him because there is no pathway to citizenship. And if we have the opportunity to pass it right now, then we need to do it because there's millions of undocumented people just like me who share the same story or even worse things that happen to them because of SB 1070 and because of anti-immigrant legislation. And this is the opportunity to pass it right now, and we need to hold you accountable to what you told us, what you promised us that you were going to pass when we knocked on doors for you. It's not right.
I'm a survivor of human trafficking, and it's because of the lack of worker protections that we don't have in the gig economy. I need you to stand by workers, lots of people who are like me, who became homeless and
And there are a lot of people telling on themselves who are way more outraged that Sinema wasn't able to pee in private than they are about her stance.
I have to say, I hadn't seen that particular clip. And I thought it was supposed to be, based upon what I saw on Twitter, I thought it was going to be a lot more aggressive. These are people going in there reading prepared statements. They had the opportunity to have an audience with her. I have been in, multi-stall bathrooms before, hearing other people talk, and it is really something that I got over.
Right. Well, she's...
Based upon the Twitter, what I saw on Twitter, I thought this was going to be much, much more dramatic.
Based upon Sinema's statement, I thought there was a crime committed, maybe.
Yeah. Yes. What, can we read her statement?
Yeah. So, I mean, she has a statement where she basically, that we can put this up. Yesterday, several individuals disrupted my class at Arizona State University after deceptively entering a locked, secure building. These individuals filmed and publicly posted videos of my students without their permission. She's very concerned about her students, including footage taken of both my students and I using a restroom where that's like holding hands. Well, I don't know. In Arizona, we love the First Amendment. We know it is vital to our democracy. Blah, 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 blah. The activist group that engaged in yesterday's behavior is one that both my team and I have met with several times since I was elected to the Senate, and I will continue engaging with Arizonans with diverse viewpoints to help inform my work for Arizona. Yesterday's behavior was not legitimate protest. This is like her outrage part. It is unacceptable for activist organizations to instruct their members to jeopardize themselves by engaging in unlawful activities such as gaining entry to closed buildings, closed university buildings, disrupting learning environments, and filming students in a restroom. She keeps, doubling down on that. The rest of this is just pablum, but she's very concerned about her students, not her public image.
I also think that the organization and these people are responsible for themselves. If they're committing an act of civil disobedience in that way, and they're doing so nonviolently, and they are doing so because they want to express the urgency of the situation and the callousness in which Sinema is approaching it, I think it's completely within their rights. She shouldn't Senate-splain them.
Right. And they are also her constituents. They are a member of an Arizona activist group. So she has to listen to them because by definition, she serves them. And she is overstating how much she has met with activist groups recently. There has been considerable reporting about how she has been not taking any local groups' calls. What she's doing is these donor retreats where they do a cocktail hour and then a morning hike, which is exactly what she flew out of DC to do. And so Lucha has been enormously successful. If everybody remembers Joe Arpaio, the sheriff from down there, they were instrumental in his ousting. So she better get it together, because this is not the kind of group that she wants to have on her bad side, although I think that's pretty much
it's also
done
unclear just what her agenda is, but we will have more to say to that in the coming days. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking with Max Chafkin, he's the features editor and writer at Bloomberg Business Week, author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel, Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. Right back after this. Folks, you may not know this. Companies around the world produce 2 billion pounds of new plastic every day. A ton of that ends up in the ocean, incidentally. Yet no matter how much we put in our recycling bin, just 9% of plastic actually gets recycled. In other words, you want to create less or purchase or use less plastic. Well, at Grove Collaborative, they believe it's time to stop making single-use plastic. You've heard me talk about Grove for a couple of years now, actually, at least. It's the online marketplace. It delivers healthy home, beauty, personal care products, all sorts of those, and they send it directly to you. Makes it very easy if you're looking for natural green products. Super easy one-stop shop. Every product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. Grove carries brands that you may know and love, like Mrs. Myers, but they also have their best-selling Grove-made products, like Seedling Tree-Free Paper Towels. Or you can try the Grove Laundry Detergent Dispenser, which cuts plastic waste by 80%. This thing's actually really cool. It's just like a carafe, and it's got one of those things where you tilt it, the perfect amount of detergent comes out, and then you pour it in. Mm. It is idiot-proof for people like myself. I get 7th generation from there, but I also have a huge stockpile of Grove-branded foaming soap. They have a pineapple. The kids love that one. And no scented soap, because that's the way I roll, ladies and gentlemen. I think everybody knows that by now. Grove was my go-to during the pandemic, too, the lockdown.
Because
the few places you get toilet paper. Join over. And it is a bamboo toilet paper, I think it is. Hmm. You can join over 2 million households who choose to shop sustainably at Grove, plus shipping fast and free on your first order. Check it out, folks. Choosing products that are better for you and the planet has never been easier. So for a limited time, when our listeners go to grove.com/majority, you're going to get to choose a free starter set with your first order. Go to grove.com/majority to get your exclusive offer. That's grove.com/majority. Check it out, folks. We will put the link to that in our podcast and YouTube description. Want to welcome to the program Max Chafkin. He's a features editor and writer at Bloomberg Business Week, author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel, Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. Max, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, all right, let's get right into this in terms of Thiel. I have to concede, I'm not as interested in his sort of biographical aspects and how he gets through. I think it can be summed up. He was a nerd. He was bullied. He decided to take it. He ran into the fountainhead, and then all of a sudden, it's off to the races.
Yeah, I think you've got it there.
And he decides to become. Well, let's just talk about. I think this is important. The René Girard elements of him learning, him adopting this contrarian posture. Speak to that for a moment.
Yeah. So, I mean, Thiel's basic idea, which he has said kind of informs his, you know, investment philosophy, and people who are really into him in Silicon Valley are very into this. René Girard talks about the way people imitate each other, and that he says basically said, he's dead now, we want the things that we want because other people desire them. Peter Thiel has said this was like a key insight that helped him sort of figure out how to be, you know, this great contrarian investor. I mean, I think part of the appeal of René Girard to Thiel was that René Girard was a conservative and Thiel was a conservative, and you know, what was going on in Teal's life. I know you didn't want to get into the backstory stuff, but what was going on in his life when he got into René Girard was he started this activist student newspaper at Stanford, the Stanford Review, which kind of modeled on the Dartmouth Review, Cornell Review. And these guys were basically, with Teal as the leader, were basically, you know, attempting to kind of, as they saw it, whatever, take the piss out of the libs, you know, to say things that were outrageous, you know, either walking right up to or crossing the line on things like race, gender, et cetera.
And I should say, like, I knew guys like this in college. I'm more or less the same age as Peter Thiel. I'm maybe a year or two older than him. And had he gone to Alabama, which he would have never gone to, but had he gone to Alabama, he could have been he could be, you know, I don't know, doing a takeover of the administration building for the sake. I mean, he wanted to stick out. And one of the things that I want to ask you about in terms of, just so we can set this table, because I'm really more interested in like how he is flexing his power now. What was he really that good of an investor? I mean, obviously the guy's got $5 billion. So, I mean, he's good. But you outline multiple times where he tried to sort of like get out of Facebook, sell off Facebook, sell PayPal earlier. It's like, you know, sometimes you get lucky. And then when you hit a certain amount of cash that you have, you need to be really, really bad to get rid of it, because there's a certain amount of inertia. I mean, this is, you know, I can tell you that, like, there's an analogy in show business. If you get on one hit show and you become famous, it could take you a decade to become without ability to make money. Like, you can just keep making bad decision after bad decision, and just there's a certain amount of inertia and a certain amount of just sort of like cachet that exists, and you ride on that for a long time. And I mean, Donald Trump, I mean, this is a guy, if he just left his money in an index fund, would probably be richer.
Yeah, I mean, I think, take your point on that. I mean, I think he's a good investor, but he's not a good investor in the way that most kind of tech people sort of think he is. And in kind of, and I think that you're right to question kind of the mythology, because as you said, so the mythology of Silicon Valley investors, right, is they see the future and they bet on it. That's not really what Peter Thiel has been doing his whole career. He's been trading on both trading, you know, sort of on these Silicon Valley startups and trying to make money on them, but also taking the other trade, betting against the U.S. economy, betting, you know, that the economy is going to collapse, which, you know, that's what happened in 2008. And that, I think, cuts against the mythology, which is, oh, he sees the future and he's betting on the future. He's often betting against the future. You know, as I wrote in the book, you know, he tried to get out of PayPal pretty much as quickly as possible. After Facebook went public, he sold most of his stock. He was not, you know, there, not always there cheering Mark Zuckerberg on to, you know, to just keep doubling down and tripling down. Now, the thing is, I think that's all defensible from an investing standpoint. I think when you're up, it does make sense sometimes to cut your losses, but it cuts against, you know, I'd say the mythology that Thiel's put forward. The other thing is, he has failed at times. And I think those times in which he's failed is really telling. So Thiel correctly called the 2008 financial crisis, but he screwed up the trade. He's what happened to him, as I wrote in the book and talking to people who worked at his investment firm, at the time he had billions of dollars under management. He was like the hottest hedge fund guy on Wall Street. And he was actually living in New York at the time. He calls the economic collapse, but then he got so sort of psyched out. The thing about contrarians, right? They're always trying to find like a countertake. And they already had the countertake, but they convinced themselves that they needed like a countertake on top of the countertake. And as a result, you know, he mistimed the market. His you know, his holdings basically collapsed. He had to turn the hedge fund into a family office. He lost a lot of investors' money. And that actually, you know, as it happens, is kind of a tangent, you know, coincides with his battle with Gawker, because Gawker had outed him in 2008, but they were also writing about this hedge fund collapse. And I think those two things together, kind of Thiel's frustration that he's being covered negatively, plus his frustration, you know, at having his sexuality become, you know, a matter of public record, is what kind of prompted his, you know, revenge plot against Gawker involving Hulk Hogan and the sex tape and on and on.
I have two questions. And let me just note this. I also saw the financial crisis coming in 2008. I didn't have any money to hedge against it. And I just told my producer at the time, dude, whatever you do, do not get into an adjustable rate mortgage because there could be a problem with the real estate bubble. That was about as far as I could do.
Same age, same insights. Maybe you guys are the same guy.
But he did avoid that. And so that worked out. But where did his original cash come from?
So he had he made some money as a and basically worked for a year in corporate law and corporate finance, and he raised a very small amount of money from friends and family. We're talking probably maybe $1 million or something like that from his buddies at Stanford and from his savings that he threw together.
Yeah, I mean, I should say, just relatively speaking, $1 million, once you get out of the halls of Bloomberg, it sounds like a lot more money than just throwing stuff together. But with that said, let's talk about, what we saw in 2016. I'm really curious about what he's doing, like what his political agenda is. I'm fascinated by him, but what you've written about him sort of cozying up to Trump because of Google, and we should say he also has made in your reporting, and I think maybe it was known as well, that he's not a big fan of competition. He has no problem principally with the idea of monopoly. He just wants it to work for him as opposed to against him, right? I mean, is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, he's you're pointing to a bunch of different contradictions. And I think the kind of easiest explanation, both the explanation for why Thiel supported Trump in 2016 and why he, why he's gone after Google, is that Peter Thiel's, is out for Peter Thiel. I think that he, there are aspects of Trump and Trumpism, I think, that appeal to Thiel. But I think he basically saw it as a trade. He saw it as a way to get influence and to be, admitted into the inner circle of a U.S. president, which would be helpful both to, his companies. He's a major shareholder in Palantir. He's the biggest shareholder in Palantir. It's a big defense contract that they've done exceedingly well, during the Trump years. And I think on the Google thing, yes, his business philosophy says that that monopoly is the endpoint of capitalism, of business, which I think really cuts against what most of us think of as being capitalism. I mean, it's an exceedingly radical point of view, or maybe he's just saying the quiet part out loud or something. And what he's done is sort of, he's continued to sit on the board of Facebook and at the same time, criticizing Google, directing a lot of this kind of anti-tech energy towards Google, which of course is, Facebook's main competitor and the main competitor or a competitor of Palantir, main competitor of many of Thiel's investments.
All right. Well, let me want to sort some of this out because his concept of a monopoly being okay when it's a monopoly that I have influence over, and I would say he probably said the same thing about government, is straight out of Mont Pelerin. I mean, this is early neoliberalism as, in its most specific design. The idea that there and it's also consistent with his notion of, and I think there's a quote, freedom and democracy are not compatible. And I mean, these are people who believe that there is some group of people who are of a higher ilk and they should be in charge of everything. But I want to dig more into this Google thing because, let me ask you this first. What you say it was like a trade-off with Trump. What was the part that he had a problem with?
Yes. I mean, I think that there's some stylistic issues, where I think Trump and Thiel are, on sort of opposite ends of the, personality spectrum. I also think that Thiel is just, objects to some of the coarseness or whatever with respect to Trump. But I think you raise a good point. On many of the core issues, Thiel is hardcore on immigration. Trump is hardcore on immigration. Thiel regards, this idea of, political correctness, as he calls it, this idea that we're not allowed to say these things as like one of the key problems in American society. And of course, that was, I think, the kind of one of the premises of Trump's candidacy, one of the core parts of the appeal. I guess what a lot of people, a lot of outsiders, the reason a lot of people found it surprising is just because Trump was running more or less on a reactionary candidacy. And Thiel has, you know, basically for his entire career talked about this need to bring, make the future happen faster. And he promotes himself as this great futurist. And I think, you know, there's just something inconsistent about those two things. But as you point out, when you get down to it, there is actually a lot of ideological agreement.
I'm curious about the anti-Googleism. I am curious about the idea of freedom and democracy no longer compatible, the anti-political correctness, this notion of freedom, because I'm looking at reflections, sort of shadows of that in our society, in our discourse. So, you know, we can look at like someone like the Mercers, for instance, and see where they've spent their dollars in developing stuff. It feels a little bit more obscured with Thiel. I'm curious about Rumble, and I'm curious about J.D. Vance, and I'm curious about what his project is, because one of the things, like, I see these reflections, at least in our little world, is Glenn Greenwald, who was actually spied on by Palantir years ago and has now become at least somewhat of a, I wouldn't say necessarily a booster of J.D. Vance, but certainly he's coming out and saying some sort of positive things. He has become a specific critic of Google in terms of their but not offering any type of antitrust stuff. Right. It's just like a malevolent figure where there's no structural reform to be had. Just deal with that. All of this looks to me very Peter Thielian.
Yeah, well, I think so a couple of things there, and people who are listening probably already know this, but J.D. Vance, in addition to writing Hillbilly Elegy, and, you know, becoming famous for that and having a Netflix movie based on it, et cetera, worked for Peter Thiel around the same time as a venture capitalist. He runs a venture capital firm now called Naria that Thiel is a major investor in. You know, the way these VC firms work, right, like an anchor investor like Peter Thiel can help more or less create the firm. So Thiel is a super important business partner to J.D. Vance in his private life, and of course has donated $10 million to J.D. Vance's super PAC. I think that the way Thiel's money works, so Thiel is not a very hands-on guy. I think he is, what he's very good at is sending signals to people like J.D. Vance and to other Republican politicians, right, that he is out there willing to spend big money on these kind of Trumpist candidacies, candidates who are going to go hard on immigration, who are going to, as you say, you know, talk about tech billionaires as the saviors that they are, as Peter Thiel sees them, and who are going to, you know, in basically in every way forward this like Thiel agenda. And I don't know if Rumble, so Vance and Thiel both invested in Rumble, that's a YouTube competitor, at the same time that Thiel has been, you know, criticizing Google relentlessly, and J.D. Vance has been criticizing Google relentlessly. And it's possible that, you know, I think it's possible that they think, who knows, maybe there's some synergy here, and actually our criticisms will work and Rumble will take off. I also think it's a way to get some press attention for both of them, frankly. And so I don't know, I don't know how seriously to take Rumble as like a threat to Google, but this is kind of classic Thiel, which is sort of combining both, you know, sort of political stuff with business stuff. And I think, you know, when I was writing the book, I was reading, Cokeland by Christopher Leonard. It's really good. And it kind of talks about the way there's this, the Coke industry is this big industrial company is feeding this political project, which was for decades, you know, trying to take over kind of the mainstream Republican Party. And I think Thiel's kind of doing a very similar thing, but with a post-industrial, you know, it's not a company. It's a collection of companies, but it's this conglomerate of Thiel's interests. And the political project, instead of trying to take over the Republican Party, it's trying to take over this, you know, the Trumpist wing of the Republican Party, or to make that the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, it feels to me like Rumble's not necessarily a play to take away from Google as much as it is a play to create to control a right wing narrative, because you are, because that ultimately is just going to be like the Fox News of, you know, I guess, the social media video. And you want to be the one who's like sort of, you know, curating it, essentially.
Yeah, and it's nice to have some, you know, Glenn Greenwald, of course, like, you know, he gets, people make fun of him a lot and everything. And it's hard to, there've been so many contradictions. I think it's sometimes hard to take him seriously. But I mean, it's nice to have Glenn Greenwald on your, you know, on your side, especially given, as you said, that Greenwald is, you know, was involved in a story with Palantir. Palantir created this presentation, you know, that basically, you know, encouraged an information operation against Glenn Greenwald. It's amazing that he's done a 180 or it seems like he's done a 180 anyway on Peter Thiel. And it seems like the money's been kind of cheap. I don't know how big the contract is, right? But it's probably, you know, in the six figures. And I know that's a lot of money, but it's not necessarily a lot of money for somebody like Thiel or even J.D. Vance.
Has Palantir reformed? Do you think that they're a better company with a more, with a better sense of their civic responsibilities and not spying on journalists and not infringing upon our civil rights?
Well, I think I think that Palantir, like all these companies in the Thiel kind of universe, basically is run according to the dictates that are laid out in Peter Thiel's book, Zero to One, and other speeches, which more or less says that doing things that are ethically questionable, breaking the rules is okay. And I think we've seen that over and over again with Palantir. You know, it's not just the instance that you brought up with Greenwald, but there's been reporting, you know, in Bloomberg and others of times when Palantir's clients have crossed the line. You know, I was told stories about Palantir salespeople, you know, going into meetings, right, with police departments, and the people on the other side of the sales call are suggesting doing things that are unethical, and the Palantir salespeople are saying, oh, well, you're technically not allowed to do that, but they're not saying don't do it, you know. And I think that, so I think for all those reasons, we should be really, really skeptical of Palantir. I mean, I do think, like, I'm sure they've had to grow up some. When you get huge government contracts, there's more compliance, I would hope. But I think there are lots of reasons to be skeptical. And I also think it's worth being skeptical of Palantir's ethics. I also think it's worth being skeptical of the company's business claims. Cause a lot of times people get spun up and they think, oh, like they're big brother, they want to do this thing with Greenwald. They must be able to, you know, basically read our minds. And I think Palantir actually kind of, it isn't as good as they say it is. And that's another reason to kind of question the company that doesn't have anything to do with ethics, just has to do with their kind of capabilities.
Well, fascinating stuff, Max Chafkin, features editor and writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, author of The Contrarian, Peter Thiel in Silicon Valley's Pursuit of Power. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Let's bring David Dayton right on, if we can, ladies and gentlemen.
Right on.
This is, for people who have watched this program for any period of time or listened to this program, they will know that there are really two things that can get me out of the bed in the morning. And that is a discussion about Social Security solvency.
Mm-hmm.
Or
tort.
Or maybe three. Or a good tort case.
Or an Apple discussion.
I'm talking politically. And the other is postal banking. And so it is with an enormous amount of excitement I welcome on the executive editor of the American Prospect, one of the only other people I know who probably be as excited about postal banking as I, without writing a book about it, David Dayton. David, it's great to see you.
Hey, it's an interesting day here.
You have a breaking story.
That's right. The United States Postal Service has taken its first steps to reestablishing a postal banking system in America.
Let's go.
There you go. Now, when you say reestablish, people are like, what? We had postal banking until when? Like the 60s, yes?
Yeah. From 1911 to 1967, we had postal savings accounts in the U.S. at its height in the 1940s, I believe. Over 4 million people had a bank account with the Postal Service.
Wow.
And this new setup won't exactly look like that. It will be a bit more modern. It's starting with really a direct competition, not so much with the banking system, but with the alternative financial services that are very predatory towards people who don't have bank accounts currently.
Walk us through why this is a big deal. I mean, because I don't think people understand just how few people can like afford a bank account essentially in this country and how much they're getting fleeced by not having a bank account.
So the latest statistics are that about one in four households have little or no access to financial services. They're either unbanked, which means they don't have a bank account at all, or they're underbanked, which means they might have a bank account, but they can't get all the services, the financial services that they need. And so they go to alternative financial services providers, check cashing stores, payday lenders, pawn shops, what have you. And those businesses are incredibly predatory. The back in 2014, when there was the first real major white paper about reestablishing postal banking, the white paper estimated that people who are unbanked and underbanked make about $25,000 a year on average, and they spend about $2,000 a year on postal on financial services, on interest and fees and all of these types of things. So this is a tremendous amount of somebody's overall payment, and it just shows how expensive it is to be poor in the United States. And so if you created a postal bank account, the number one reason to do it is to promote financial inclusion, to allow people who are unbanked and underbanked to have some access to the financial system. The secondary thing is to, I'm sorry, just a second.
No, it's all
the secondary thing. Yeah. The secondary thing is to raise money, to create revenue, a new revenue source for the Postal Service. But even that revenue source will be much smaller and will create much more savings for these individuals than having to use check cashing stores, payday lenders, et cetera.
Well, you answered my question there. The bulk of these like fees that are associated with, say, you are underbanked or you're not banked at all, are through these payday lenders and predatory loans, which have been, by the way, greenlit and okayed and loosened in terms of restrictions for decades now by the legislature.
Right.
I want to talk about those fees, though. Right. I think you said is it $5 or $5.95 for up to $500? Is that what it is?
And yeah. OK, so let's explain what this is. Yeah. So right now, the Postal Service sells gift cards. They sell Olive Garden gift card, Barnes & Noble, Starbucks, what have you. They also sell a generic Visa gift card. So this is like what you see at the supermarket, right? And they sell them for $5.95. And you can put any amount of money on these gift cards when you buy them. So what they're saying, really, this is the only innovation here. This is a very limited pilot. It's only happening in four cities and at one post office location in each city. And the cities are Falls Church, Virginia, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and the Bronx, New York. In the Bronx location is in Baychester. Instead of having to pay cash for these gift cards that are already sold at the post office, you can use a payroll check or a business check, and they can be up to $500. So $5.95 for a $500 check is, you know, a little bit more than 1% of the value of that payroll check. Most large check cashing services charge you a percentage rate of 3% of the value of the check. And so for a $500 check, that would be $15. So you're getting a somewhat significant savings, about two-thirds, by using the Postal Service. Now, I feel like this is too much money because
if you Walmart. Have 250, and if you have a $250 check, all of a sudden,
that's right. It's all of a sudden it's larger.
Yeah.
Walmart has a flat rate as well. Flat rate isn't necessarily a problem if you underprice the competition. Walmart has a flat rate for up to $500. I believe up to $1,000. They charge you $4. The Postal Service needs to get under $4 for this service. Initially, when I talked to the American Postal Workers Union, they said they wanted to see this between $2 and $3. So I think what's happening right now is they're literally just testing the system to see if it will work. Already, gift cards are $5.95. They kept the number the same. They're testing to see, can I scan a check and get it and get the gift card into somebody's hands? And if I can do that, then I'll go out not only to multiple locations within a city, but I will also, you know, deal with the price point situation so that we can increase the volume.
Okay. You mentioned the union. This is the part that I found fascinating about it, because talk about the history of the we've had Mark Dimenstein on the program back in the day, specifically to talk about the sort of the burden on the post office to pre-fund its health insurance and, you know, 75 years out, which is a bizarre requirement. But tell us the union's involvement in this historically and what they did in this instance. And then Louis DeJoy is I don't have to like this guy now, do I?
Well, let's go through it. So the American Postal Workers Union has been a long and strong supporter of postal banking. I remember at Netroots Nation in 2014, I did a panel discussion, and I had a member of the Postal Workers Union there, the executive to the president, who was Dimenstein at the time, along with other people who were advocates. So this has been a long time coming. So in 2016, the Postal Workers Union, their contract was up, and they said, okay, we're going to demand a pilot for postal banking in our collective bargaining agreement.
Why?
And they did.
Why are they so interested in this?
Well, the postal workers want to see the post office to be viable, and they feel that this is a way to viability. Two, it fits with the mission of the Postal Service to promote commerce and to get everybody, you know, connect the country, get everyone involved. They feel like the volume and therefore their worth as Postal Service members can be expanded through the production of good financial services. I think they see it in the same way that a lot of people see it, is that this is about promoting commerce and promoting financial inclusion first, but it also does create a revenue source for the Postal Service,
right,
and makes it more indispensable.
Right.
So anyway, 2016 rolls around. They ask for this in contract negotiations, and they win it in contract negotiations. Since 2016, there has been this memorandum that says you Postal Service has to create pilots for a postal banking system. And the last Postmaster General, Megan Brennan, just ignored it. She just didn't do it. She just said, I'm not going to do this. There were discussions in 2017, 2018, 2019. They just didn't do it. So Louis DeJoy comes in May of 2020. And the Postal Workers Union, which has been very critical of Louis DeJoy in many, many other contexts, pretty much every other context. But in May of 2020, they come to DeJoy. They have a sit-down meeting. And they personally lobby him and say, look, this is in the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement. We think that this could be a great tool to modernize the Postal Service, bring it into the 21st century. And DeJoy is a businessman, and he thinks, yeah, maybe so. And they sell him on it. And they start having these weekly meetings, these kind of secret meetings that nobody really knew about, to go over how it could be technically done. And they fall on this check cashing thing. And the reason that they did it this way is because you don't need any more authority from Congress. You do not have to get Mitch McConnell to sign off to start a postal banking pilot of this type. And the reason is they're already selling the gift cards. This is just what they can, you know, what they can accept as payment for the gift card. Now, These are single-use gift cards. Here's where this can expand and actually become more like a bank-like product. These are single-use gift cards. What if they were reloadable, what they call reloadable gift cards? In other words, every time you get a...
Oh, you paused.
Payroll check. You can cash it and put it onto this gift card. Hello? Am I here?
Yeah, you broke up for a minute, but I think we have you back.
Okay. All right. So what I was saying is here's where this pilot, which is very limited, can turn into a bank-like product. So you have these gift cards are single-use gift cards. So you purchase them, you use them up, and you throw them away. You could make it a reloadable gift card where all of your payroll checks are put onto this card. You could have an ATM right in the postal service so that you can use it as a no-fee ATM for that gift card, and you can take money out in cash. You can have some sort of digital record of your balance that you could check on the gift card. And you could have a Venmo-like service where you can transfer payments from the gift card to somebody else who has that, or do location to location from one postal service, post office to another.
Well, once you get that, once you get that gift card set up too, it seems to me that you could then start engaging a Venmo or whatever it is, right?
That's right.
And you can use it as a revenue store. I mean, as a funding source.
Right. And right now, these are generic branded cards, but they could be branded U.S. Postal Service. The ATMs could be branded that way. And at that point, you effectively have a bank account.
Do you need any more authority to get to where you just talked about from Congress?
I mean, that's a very good question. I don't think so. But I mean, I'm not a lawyer. And we'd have to look at some of the legal aspects of this, but I think you could do a lot of this on your own. When you're talking about simple bank accounts, money orders, I mean, you know, Postal Service already does money orders right now. You could bundle them with the gift card to pay bills through the gift card. There's already an international transfer, money transfer system at the post office to 9 Latin American countries. You could do that domestically. That would be an expansion of an existing product. There's a rule in one of, I believe it's the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act that says you can't offer new products without Congress's approval. But none of these are new products. The gift cards already exist. Money orders already exist. The money transfer already exists. If you can expand those, and you can expand those enough, I think, to get you something that looks like a bank account.
And we should say, just as a, you know, I mean, this is a policy that you've got, what is it, 35,000 post offices around the country? I don't know exactly the number, but you're talking rural, urban, you're talking, I mean, this is something that would service everyone.
Every zip code.
Every zip code, obviously, and allow people who are being subject to these sort of these predatory practices just to allow them to get the money that they've been paid and use that money. You're talking about people who are being subject. People who are making $25,000 a year being subjected to like a 10% tax on top of everything else just to use their money. I have a theory about DeJoy as to why he was happy with this, because he's a logistics guy. I think he is very happy for, he doesn't care about the post office existing as long as it's not providing, inhibiting the growth of the private logistics companies, it seems to me.
And also, but maybe he also just
sees it.
As a cheap revenue source, right? I mean, like as you say, David, he's a businessman, right? So if you can make money out of something where he's not able to tap into that market currently, and he's able to tap into that market now as head of the Postal Service.
And I think it's about logistical tactical advantage. So one of the ways that I was told that the APWU sold this to DeJoy was they talked about how in other countries, for example, Switzerland, if you have a postal bank account and you buy something online like a pair of shoes and you get the shoes and they don't fit, you can take the shoes to the post office, say, I want to return these shoes. And also, you know, I want to, you know, credit my account when I get the shoes back to the retailer. And they can do that, that you can ship and do the banking at the same place at the same time. And I believe the Postal Service thinks that that puts them at a tactical advantage over UPS or FedEx, where that's two different things. So it centralizes the both the shipping angle and the crediting of account angle at the same time.
And so we don't need to have whatever it is, a majority of the Postal Commission heads in favor of this. I mean, wasn't that sort of like what we were waiting for on some level?
Yeah, well, I mean, if DeJoy's for it, and the board is right now actually majority Democratic, seemingly everybody is moving in the same direction. There are a couple vacancies still on the Postal Service Board of Governors, and I would strongly suggest that a strong postal banking advocate be among the remaining choices that gets on that board, because right now we have this pilot, and I feel, you know, the union is very much not just in favor of this, but very interested in the details, and they understand the issue at a very granular level. DeJoy has done, you know, the bare minimum right now. This is a baby step. This is the first thing that you have to do in order to get to a place where you have a bank account like product at the Postal Service. You're going to need somebody in management who understands this issue keenly to get it across the line. And so I would argue that we probably do need another member of that board that really understands postal banking in order to maximize its potential.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back. And David, if you can hang around for just a couple more minutes, because I want to ask you about another piece you wrote about and your take on the Progressive Caucus and what they were able to do on Thursday. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Sure. A
minute and 4 seconds.
Okay, yeah, I had down to 4 seconds. All right, we're back. And just to wrap up this conversation, David, about the Postal Service, what do we have a sense of, like, what's the timing? There's four cities, four post offices that are doing this. What's phase two?
I mean, it's a good question. I think now that it's out in public, members of Congress are interested in this. I got notes today from Senator Warren, Senator Gillibrand, Representative Bill Pascrell, some of the big champions. They're going to test this product to see if it works. And I think there's going to be some momentum to figure out the end of that test, if it does in fact work, to expand this pretty rapidly. I mean, I think that everybody's expectation is that the next step would be to go to every postal location in those pilots, and to then look at the price point and to look at the volume. And then to do those add-ons, which, I mean, this is going to take a while overall, but I do think we're gonna get some rapid changes.
Okay, and we just want to say goodbye to our Peacock viewers. We will see you tomorrow, and see you then.
See you then.
And for everybody else, let's stick around here. So, David, so the last question. So we don't know right now. This is a 90-day pilot. This is a 120-day pilot.
It's open ended. Okay. Yeah. So we don't know exactly. But I mean, I know that everybody's really interested in it. And I should say that we actually had our art director, John Dos Rothstein, test this. We went to a postal location in Falls Church, Virginia with a prospect business check, and we got it successfully put onto a gift card. And, and the whole process took like 2 minutes. Oh, and this is viable.
It's so great. I'm so excited about this. I appreciate your contacting me. It was, and I did guess, right? You said, we should talk on Monday. You're going to be interested. And I said, post office?
that's right.
All right.
That's right.
So Emma's had to step away just for a minute, but let me ask you this. You also wrote a piece, I guess it was on Friday, The Progressive Caucus Wields Power. Just give me your take on this. I mean, I don't know that it's like, I think we've been more or less talking about this, that this represents a change in dynamic, and we may not see the implications of this. I mean, this is a big deal, I think, that they were able, because I really do think that the plan here, and you made the point in this piece, Manchin had said, we don't vote on the infrastructure, on the reconciliation before October 1st. And Gottheimer said, we need to vote on the other one by September 27th. I mean, that's their plan. We need to decouple these, yeah. And then all of a sudden, we have all the leverage, and everybody else is pushing against the string. And by holding these together, we're not going to get the number that we want, but the number really is irrelevant. There's a lot of different ways in which to make a $3.5 trillion project over 10 years into a $2 trillion thing over 5 years, and say to, you know, the Republicans, you guys want to be the ones to cut universal pre-K? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, our Harold Meyerson wrote that exact piece last week, like run on the 2024 elections on this. Yeah, I mean, I think if you're looking at these numbers and being like, well, they're going from 3.5 to 1.5, they were headed to zero. I mean, that was the way that this was going was we were going to get the infrastructure bill. It was going to be delinked. Democrats were going to pass that in the House. And then there was no leverage over Manchin or Sinema to actually get them pinned down at all. And then we hit 2022 and we hit the elections and the whole agenda falls apart. That's where we were headed before progressives decided to take this stand. And so the number that is critical here is zero. So if you get 1.5 trillion more than zero, or 2 trillion or 2.5 trillion, that's how much more you got than what you were likely to get. So that's part one. But the piece that I wrote was really as much about the history of the Progressive Caucus, which started actually 30 years ago in 1991. And it started with 6 members, so it didn't really have any ability.
It was some like just complete backbencher who nobody took seriously in the House.
That's right.
Who was one of the leaders. This guy who came from Vermont, of all places, named Bernie Sanders, who was one of the early leaders.
That's right. We founded the Progressive Caucus, but the Progressive Caucus, through its 30-year history, for the majority of members who had joined it, was essentially a resume line item. It was, I am part of the Progressive Caucus, so I can put that on my flyer when I send it to my constituents every 2 years. There was no guarantee that that meant they would vote in a certain way. There was no guarantee that that meant that they would join together as a block to ensure a certain policy got forwarded. It was a debate club. It really wasn't much of a coherent coalition. For about 15 years, from 2003 to I think 2018, there were co-chairs of the Progressive Caucus, and that didn't mean there was twice as much organizing. It kind of meant there was half as much organizing. Right. There was just not. Sometimes the co-chairs weren't on the same page, and they didn't want to upstage one another, or they didn't want to be upstaged by one another. It just was not a force within Congress. It was just sort of this other appendage, and that really changed with the ascension of Pramila Jayapal, who joined Congress after the 2016 elections, became co-chair after the 2018 elections, and became the sole chair after the 2020 elections. So a pretty rapid ascent. And Jayapal is an organizer. She's someone who came out of that world in Seattle. And she really is pretty responsible for turning the Progressive Caucus into a force that can set the terms of legislation. And they did that a few times in the 2019 and 2020. But, you know, Mitch McConnell was in control of the Senate, so there wasn't a lot of follow through there, but that wasn't really her fault. But this year, there was this moment. There's a very narrow majority in the House for Nancy Pelosi. Democrats have the Senate. Democrats have the presidency. And Jayapal recognized that this gave a real opportunity to the Progressive Caucus to really, you know, if they saw something going not in their direction, that they could take a stand and then hold to it, because the Progressive Caucus has taken stands before. They 60 of them, I think, wrote there has to be a public option in the Affordable Care Act or else we're not going to vote for it. And then all of them voted for it. Like not most of them, all right. of them voted for it after. I mean, it just wasn't,
to
they
be
didn't
fair.
Have this fortitude. They didn't have this organizing skill.
Right. I mean, I guess maybe Bernie was in the Senate at that point and got the community, the money into those co-ops.
Yeah.
Those community co-ops. But this is a big deal for that very reason you just said. Like, you know, I've used this example and I've been trying desperately to find the clip, but I know you'll remember it. I think there was a moment in Happy Days where Fonzie is teaching Richie Cunningham how to fight. And, you know, it is revealed that that Fonzie only hit one guy. He said, I hit this one guy, and ever since then, I don't have to hit anybody again. Is this that moment for the progressives where it's like all of a sudden now the normal calculation is, okay, I can make this deal with Gottheimer because at the end of the day, the Progressive Caucus is going to fold. The next time around, and obviously there may not even be a next time around for a long time, maybe not even for Nancy Pelosi, frankly. I mean, who knows how much longer she's going to be Speaker. But the next time around, from the get-go, there's going to be a different calculation, and that different calculation means that there won't have to be this intermediate fight, right? I mean, because the progressives have just used their strength level meter. They've just used that in a big way. They're still going to hold the line with the numbers, but also, you know, Biden's in that fight aggressively, obviously, on the number side. Mm-hmm. Next time around, they may not have to use that number just because that there's an awareness that they actually will use it. And so you don't make a deal with Gottheimer in that way. You have to refashion something else that requires less expenditure of energy by the progressives. And it could change the dynamic in which this is working going forward. A, let me ask you about that. And B, you know, let's say that out of the 100 people in the Progressive Caucus, whatever it is, 96 or something, do people cross that divide into like, I wasn't just using this as a, you know, I was using this as a branding exercise, but I wasn't prepared to take that vote. Do a couple of them say like, you know what, this is working for them. They're not paying a price here. I think I can slide into that camp, and that maybe next time, instead of getting 45 people who claim that they're going to vote against this, and I know you guys did some great work in terms of the whipping with maybe it was closer to 24 publicly, but next time maybe it's like 55 or something like that.
Well, first, I really only paid attention to the Ralph Mouth
Right. Days
episodes.
So, right.
Yeah, I
can't back confirm that,
I back
that element of it.
Reference.
Well, okay. All right, fair enough. That may have been a little bit before your time. I know you came more when they went out.
However, I think you're absolutely right. So what this gets the Progressive Caucus regardless of what happens ultimately with this bill, is it gets them respect. And it gets them respect from the leadership in Congress for certainly the remainder of this Congress and maybe the future. And it gets them respect from the sort of media institutions within Washington, that Pramila Jayapal is a player here, that you have to pay attention to this left flank because legislation depends on it. And so I think that respect has never been there before. And there was this expectation level that, yes, we can cut a deal with the 218th member of the House, and whatever that 218th member wants is what everybody else is going to have to swallow. And that calculus has to change now, that progressives need to be read into whatever deal gets made. And that's different, and that's new, and it's definitely something to watch. And I do think that that courage can be contagious, that I think we had 29 members who publicly said they were going to withhold their vote. And in reality, Jayapal said it was probably closer to 50 or 60 if they actually held it on the floor. And it could be more next time, not necessarily on this bill, but on a similar kind of situation. It could be more. I do think sort of there is a moth to a flame kind of element of this, where, you see somebody succeed and you see someone do a power move and you want to be part of that. And you see it as a way to get your priorities done. And so I think on both counts, this is definitely, a changed reality within the Congress.
All right. Well, David, I'm sure we're going to have you back sometime between now and the 31st of October when Chuck Schumer claims both these bills will be up for a vote. I cannot encourage people enough to head over to the American Prospect and read about, because I would imagine within days you're going to start to have reporting. This is how they're going to drop these numbers, and it's either going to be, and I think you explained this to me on the unreported on the other Peacock show, there's multiple ways in which you can do this. You can take a 10-year if something costs $20 over 10 years, you can say it only costs $10 and do it for 5 years. And that program still exists, and it's just a question of whether you leave it up to the next Congress to fund, or you can do half-ass job on all of them and make them clunky and not work. And so it may look like it's a good program, but it ends up being hurting it in the long term. That dynamic is something we're going to be looking for your reporting and the other reporting that goes on at the American Prospect. So as always, appreciate it. And I really do appreciate you calling me as soon as you knew about this post office thing.
You're the first person I called, Sam. I know that this is your hobby horse.
Like it just like all weekend, I was just like bursting at the seams. Like who can tell? Like it would be safe to tell my child. Like I get it.
You were sworn to secrecy and you did a good job with that.
I didn't even I hinted at it to my 8-year-old only because he doesn't have any social media, but he didn't care.
Yeah, he didn't see it as he didn't ask you about the finer points of it.
I needed to articulate it to him. At one point I said, could be postal banking soon. And he was like
and he said, can I watch the TV now?
He was like, do you know where my iPad is?
Yeah, right.
Is that a new Marvel character?
David Denton, executive editor of the American Prospect. Always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
Thanks.
Folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. But first, let me tell you this. It is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today, right this moment, by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you also get extra content virtually every day. So check it out. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. They had something right now. They have custom labeled bags.
Wow. What?
At Just Coffee. You got to check this out, actually. It's pretty cool.
I got to order some new cold brews. So.
You can get... Oh, I got to do this. This is a great... I mean, this is for the holidays. You can get... You can get bags filled with the Revolution Roast that... like 20 of them, I guess. I think is the minimum. But great, great gifts. Or for your organization or something like that. I don't know. Check it out. JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Also, don't forget our Discord, MajorityDiscord.com. Over 4,000 members now in the Discord.
Wow.
Powerhouse. Powerhouse. Also, don't forget Nomi Show, YouTube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. YouTube.com/TheNomiKeyShow. Matt. It's happening in the Matt Leckian universe of media.
For patrons of Left Reckoning, on Sunday we put up a conversation we had with Sam Hoadley Brill, a PhD student who's written on what I'm calling the CRT party, or the CRT panic, where people like James Lindsay and Chris Ruffo, who we deal with specifically, have been misleading parents into thinking public schools are turning their kids into Black Panthers. Not that there'd be anything wrong with that, but... yeah, so patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that episode. It's about 50 minutes. We went for a long time. So, and Sam's as good as anybody at covering these freaks. So patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right, folks, the number is 646-257-3920. I'm going to turn on the phones, but I'm going to warn you now. We got to end a little bit early today because I've got some important personal stuff to deal with. And so we may not get to many calls. But if you want to venture in, well, you be my guest. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
Come on.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price.
It's a blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.